You're listening to Fighting Terror, a podcast that explores the approaches to fighting terror and extremism in the U.S., Europe, and worldwide. With Lucinda Crate, Senior Europe Advisor to the Counter-Extremism Project and former Europe Minister. This podcast is brought to you by the Counter-Extremism Project, a research and advocacy group that combats the activities of terrorist and extremist groups globally.
Hello and welcome. In today's final episode of CEP's Eye on Anti-Semitism podcast series, we will turn to the European Union and look at what the EU is currently doing to combat anti-Semitism. With us today, I'm delighted to say, is Katharina von Schnurbein, the European Commission Coordinator for the EU Strategy on Combating Anti-Semitism and Fostering Jewish Life. She was appointed the very first European Commission Coordinator on Combating Anti-Semitism in December 2015. Her mandate includes liaising closely with the Jewish community on behalf of the European Commission, proposing and implementing European Commission policy to prevent and fight anti-Semitism. So, Katharina, thank you so much for joining us today. You're very welcome.
Lucinda, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. So to kick off, I guess many of our listeners won't be all that familiar with the EU's work in this area. So perhaps you could provide us with an overview of the EU's strategy on combating anti-Semitism and fostering Jewish life. What are the goals and objectives and so on?
So I believe with regards to the situation on anti-Semitism, not only in Europe, but really with regards to global rise in anti-Semitism that we've seen in recent years, it was the right thing to do and a necessary step in 2015 for the European Commission to appoint a coordinator that would address anti-Semitism in more targeted and a more direct way. I was appointed together with a coordinator on combating anti-Muslim hatred. And these appointments happened not only after we had seen significant, unfortunately, even lethal attacks on the Jewish community, but also the attack on Charlie Hebdo in January 2015, which resulted in a rise of anti-Muslim hatred as a consequence. So the situation has, as you already said, the role of the coordinator of my office is, first of all, to really listen to the Jewish communities as to what their challenges are. I believe when we started, there was little knowledge in the European Commission as such as to the fact how diverse the situation is for Jewish communities, depending on the size, depending on their cooperation with the government, on their history, the way the government acted during the Shoah. All of these elements play a role. And in that sense, also the question and how anti-Semitism plays out in the different countries and on the various communities today. So this was my first focus. And I traveled a lot across Europe to really listen and to report to the political level. Now it's Vice President Skinas who is responsible for the fight against anti-Semitism as part of the College of Commissioners. And when President von der Leyen came into office in 2019, in December, 10 days into her mandate, she said, you know, the EU needs to do more on anti-Semitism. And that is because anti-Semitism is a challenge to the Jewish communities and addressing the Jewish communities in the first place, but as a second aspect, also addressing or targeting democracy, our values, even rule of law, you know, the diversity and the aspect of a liberal democracy. So this has been the focus and has been my focus. We subsequently had to propose concrete policies that started with a definition on anti-Semitism, about which we will maybe talk a bit more later, and also to propose concrete policy measures, which we did in a EU strategy on combating anti-Semitism and fostering Jewish life in October 2021. And there we have three main elements: addressing and combating anti-Semitism online and offline, data collection, making it visible, ensuring that governments on all levels understand the need to address anti-Semitism. In the second aspect, it's security as a prerequisite to ensuring Jewish life and to foster Jewish life. So security being the main responsibility of the member states vis-a-vis their citizens, and therefore also vis-a-vis the Jewish citizens. And on the other side, to ensure that Jewish life can prosper, because we know from history that whenever Jews felt that they could no longer be in Europe, it was bad for Europe as well. So we do this obviously with regards to the sake of the Jewish community, ensuring that they see a future in Europe, but again, also this aspect of it has wider implications. Mm-hmm. And the third pillar is education and research, not only on the Holocaust, but also on anti-Semitism, on Jewish life, where at the moment we very much look to the United States or the UK when we need data, for example, on demography or on aspects of really how Jews live in Europe from a research point of view. And we want to make sure that we develop our own expertise here in Europe as well. And then all these three aspects should be reflected also in our external efforts. So the EU in international organizations, in our collaboration with partner countries, making it part of human rights dialogues with third countries, of political dialogues, ensuring that we call out anti-Semitism also when it happens from a stateside, for example, in third countries. And so all these aspects then should reflect also in our external action.
That's extremely comprehensive and really interesting to hear how you've approached it since coming into the office. You mentioned the definition of anti-Semitism, and I'm wondering, in the context of the EU strategy, is there anything novel or different about that definition of anti-Semitism, or is it sort of aligned with the UN definition, or is there some additional focus for you?
So for us, the benchmark for a definition is the anti-Semitism definition of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, so the so-called IRA definition. Mm-hmm. And that has in its examples to what, as we could measure it by a survey among 16,500 Jews in Europe in 2018, it reflects what the majority of Jews regard as anti-Semitic in Europe. And that means, on the one side, when you ask Jews here, what is the most pernicious form of anti-Semitism, it's Holocaust related. The fact that Jews brought the Holocaust upon themselves, that they capitalized today from the Holocaust and so on. And then when you ask what is the form you encounter most, it's Israel related anti-Semitism. And in particular, the idea that the way the Israelis treat the Palestinians is like the Nazis treated the Jews. And the question for us and the approach that we have taken has been a victim-based approach. So to really listen to what those concerned regard as anti-Semitic and also regard as their identity. And Israel plays an important role there. And while people might not agree, Jews might not agree with the policy and the politics of Israel, they very often say, you know, Israel's existence cannot be questioned, because when everything goes wrong here, this time I know where I'm going. And I think this aspect is important to recognize in this whole debate. And for us, therefore, any definition that omits the relationship with Israel is not useful. And we've used this definition also, for example, for training purposes with the police, with the judiciary, because in order to establish a bias, you need to first recognize that there is an aspect to it. So yeah, for us, this definition has become the benchmark, and we recommend it to member states to adopt it, to civil society, to universities, to sports clubs. You know, we think that it's a good starting point.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And I think that sense of identity and the connection to the state of Israel is really fundamental to this, because failing to understand that can lead to all sorts of politicization and disregard, I suppose.
Indeed,
for many concerns. Yeah, exactly. So you mentioned how that definition becomes part of the basis for the training of police and judiciary. That too is really interesting, and maybe brings us to look at the European Union's approach to both the prevention and the prosecution of anti-Semitic crimes. And I think it'd be interesting to learn a little bit about how that is approached within the EU and how much of a priority that is.
Yes, first of all, we have said that We regard as European Commission, European Union, all forms of anti-Semitism as equally pernicious. So it means that, you know, right-wing, left-wing, Islamist extremism, but also anti-Semitism coming from the center of society. The fact that Jews don't necessarily disclose their identity at the workplace because they don't want to hear a comment about their prime minister violating human rights or these kind of things. Yeah, so it's very important, I think, also as a starting point to really acknowledge this, even if anti-Semitic expressions are not illegal and many of the forms of anti-Semitism identified in the IRA definition are not necessarily illegal, but they still create an atmosphere that is toxic for the Jewish community. And that's why for us, all these forms need to be addressed. With regards to the illegal forms and the hate crime, the hate speech aspects to anti-Semitism. So we have strong legislation in Europe. It started in 2008 with the EU framework decision on combating racism and xenophobia, where we created a strong legal framework to combat anti-Semitic hate crimes and hate speech, and including in particular also the denial and cross-criminalization of the Holocaust, which is illegal across the EU. And what we have done recently is to launch infringement procedures against countries that had not correctly transposed this piece of legislation, because it's really a basis that we need a level playing field across the EU with regards to hate crime and hate speech, because that also has an influence, for example, on data collection. We are currently developing a methodology to record anti-Semitic hate crime and hate speech, but also, as I said before, below the hate crime level, in order to catch also those areas that are simply toxic and create this environment to make anti-Semitism visible, because that will create political action. We have also passed legislation with regards specifically to illegal content online, because the internet is the main entry door for anti-Semitism into our living rooms, and it needs rules and regulations in order to make sure that the platforms operate within the law. And what we want to create with the so-called Digital Services Act that was recently passed, a situation where the internet again becomes the place where we all want to be. Now, we've become so used to having a bunch of hate speech following every tweet or every post, but in fact, this is not a sustainable situation. So, for example, what the DSA does, this Digital Services Act, is to request from the platforms, and for now we've identified 19 big platforms with more than 45 million users, to disclose towards the authorities, in this case, the European Commission and their national authorities, the algorithms in order to see whether they pose a risk towards society in the end, towards fundamental rights. And they have to become much more transparent. They have to find better redress mechanisms. There needs to be possibilities for users to know when something is not taken down or why something is taken down. All these things need to be much more direct. And we believe that with this legislation, we will create an environment where we can also make sure that anti-Semitic hate speech is addressed in a much more direct way. Then the terrorist content online. This is an important legislation when it comes to taking down within 1 hour of detecting terrorist content. And this is already now in place in the EU for some time. We also believe that it's important to train, for example, state prosecutors specifically on anti-Semitism, that we need to train judges, and that thereby, or the police also, but of course also the teachers, but now we are talking here about crime and hate speech. Yeah, so the situation is really towards law enforcement authorities, and to make sure that they recognize it, including also, for example, when there are demonstrations on the street that call death to the Jews, that action needs to be taken. This is not a political opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is something that we have seen in several member states in recent years. And I think having clear guidelines and regulation in terms of how to respond is really important for law enforcement to be able to behave correctly and take action.
I think also when it comes to the internet, because of the conspiracy and the idea that the Jews are behind the evil of the world, we have seen how short the link is between posting something online and action and hate crime in the real world. We saw it in the Halle synagogue shooting, where the perpetrator believed that Soros was sending, so a Jew was sending Muslims to Europe to replace the Germans. We've seen it in several cases in France. You know, so these aspects are really key to understand this link, how conspiracy myths can actually turn into action very quickly. And it's for that reason that we need to also address these aspects on the net. And why we are, by the way, for within the strategy, creating now a network of fact checkers and trusted flaggers that can detect in all EU languages and in non-EU languages that transport anti-Semitic content into the EU, this anti-Semitic content, and then see whether it's hate speech needs to be taken down or is not necessarily illegal, but needs counter speech fact checking and these kind of reactions.
Absolutely. And interesting with the terrorist content online regulation, the Counter-Extremism Project was very actively involved in the early stages of developing that legislation. And now that it is in force, you know, some member states are maybe not as proactively implementing in the way they should. And we see the Commission having to really apply pressure on the member states. So it's good to see it's happening, but it's perhaps disappointing. Yeah. Some of the member states are slow to implement this legislation. I think your role and your title are very interesting because you cover anti-Semitism, but you also cover this interesting concept of fostering Jewish life. And I think as we've gone through the various episodes of this podcast series, this has been actually a theme, you know, that anti-Semitism isn't just an extreme group. It's not just isolated, that it actually comes from narratives and dynamics in society that perhaps go unaddressed. So I'd love to hear more about this part of your role and how you have seen it evolve and how you actually go about promoting Jewish life in Europe.
Actually, when I was appointed as coordinator on combating anti-Semitism. And when President von der Leyen came into office, I asked whether we could add this aspect of fostering Jewish life to it, because I came to realize in the first 3-4 years of my mandate that in the end, anything that we do, yes, we fight and we are against, and we have this very clear vision of rolling anti-Semitism back, and in the end of wanting to defeat it, even if we are not naive, we know 2000 years of anti-Semitism are not going to be defeated tomorrow. But we need to have this high standard and the ultimate aim in front of our eyes all the time, I believe, in order to move forward step by step. But the ultimate aim of what we do is to ensure that Jews can go about their lives in Europe in line with their religious and cultural traditions, free from security concerns, and that is what we really need to promote, to foster, and to ensure. And so in collaboration also with the Jewish communities and in the conversations that we had, it was clear that there are certain aspects that need to be strengthened. And from my point of view, I think that we as EU institutions that were built on the Second World War, on a never again towards the Shoah, we have a responsibility with regards to the Jewish community, because they, you know, we have very small Jewish communities today, and not because they left and found better places elsewhere, but because they were systematically killed in the Shoah. And so it is our responsibility as institutions, but I believe personally also as states and as governments, to ensure that Jewish life can prosper. And what we have concretely seen, first of all, I said already, security is a prerequisite. This means that the national states in particular, but also we with EU funding, need to ensure the security of Jewish communities, and that it is not for the Jewish communities to pay for these measures that are unfortunately necessary, because we see in many countries that it is still to a large extent left to the communities to do so. And we would not request that of any other group. This is one aspect. And then the fostering Jewish life means that we create an environment in which Jews in their diversity can live their daily lives In recent years, we have seen, for example, that some countries have banned or have tried to ban, attempted to ban kosher slaughter, often triggered by wanting to ban halal slaughter. And we have seen even a court judgment following the situation in Belgium, which said that there needs to be a balance between animal welfare and freedom of religion. And in Belgium, where it was banned, in particular in Flanders at the time, this balance has been found. What we did as a reaction was to invite Jewish and Muslim representatives to explain to representatives from the EU member states what these bans, what kind of effects they have on their livelihood, and that it is not necessarily about the access to meat. It's really the stigmatization, the fact that you are seen as backwards, as not in line with the broader values. And that was, I think, an important role that we had there, by the way, together with the UN, the OSCE and the Council of Europe, to facilitate this exchange. So, you know, while we fully respect, of course, the court ruling, I think it's we have this role also to bring this knowledge to member states. Mm-hmm. Another aspect is that we want to see Jewish organizations in different areas to also work together, and not only Jewish organizations, but also those who tackle Jewish issues in a wider sense. So we invited 200 organizations from across Europe in November for a three-day seminar to liaise around eight different topics with regards also to applying for EU funding. And that's another aspect. We need to put our money where our mouth is, yeah, to ensure that we can finance projects on a national and local level, that we create networks where they are necessary across Europe, and to therefore also ensure that Jewish life can prosper through these projects.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Maybe then just to look a little bit at the EU, obviously you are responsible for the EU strategy. How does that interplay with the member states then? Is there a lot of cooperation? Is it complementary? How does that work?
Actually, I've always said, you know, we can decide on European level whatever we want, unless it is embraced and transposed in the member states, it's not going to change the situation for the Jewish communities. So cooperation with member states is key, just as much as cooperation with civil society and Jewish organizations is key. We created in 2019 a working group on combating anti-Semitism in the European Commission, where we invite twice per year two representatives per member state. And we have a specificity that we invite also one elected official of the Jewish community of each country. We place them next to each other. And so we create the possibility to discuss certain aspects on education, on security, on the IRA definition, on data collection on European level. But then we always give 20 minutes for so-called discussions under six eyes to see how the situation is in the national context. And now I believe that this has created communication structures on the national level that are very important. However, this was not always so. Of course, it was like that in the, you know, there were close cooperation in the bigger countries. But I had a comment from one of the smaller countries after the first meeting, and the representative of the Jewish community told me I had more time in this one meeting in Brussels with my national authorities than I ever had in my capital. So I think this has created the possibility for member states and Jewish communities to work much closer together. And also we proposed in our strategy towards the member states three main aspects. One is to use the IRA definition, to adopt it and to use it in training and for law enforcement, for teachers and so on. Secondly, to appoint a to-go-to person, can be a coordinator, special envoy, to coordinate the fight against anti-Semitism on national level and also as an interface with the Commission. And thirdly, and this is very important, for all member states to have their own national strategies on combating anti-Semitism. And that they agreed to by unanimity last March. And we have seen a lot of national strategies adopted since, which means that in the end, the structures change. the system reacts. When you create a strategy, we saw that also here on European level, you have to reach out to the different departments or ministries, ask them what their contribution will be, and, you know, push them to be ambitious. And so in our case, for example, we have from 17 of the 20-something director generals of the Commission, we have concrete contributions in our strategy, which makes up almost 100 concrete actions that we will implement by 2030. Yeah, so this process has created a situation where we build up structures and then the system reacts, and it's not just individual people. And I think this is actually where we want to get to in order then, as the next step, to ensure that the wider public reacts and that there will be tangible change for the Jewish communities locally.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, as you say, anti-Semitism has been with us for thousands of years. So it's not that it's going to disappear overnight. But these are concrete actions that at least elevate the level of priority at member state level. And that's a very interesting observation from that Jewish community representative, that they had more time meeting with their own national government representatives in Brussels than at home, which perhaps speaks volumes in terms of the need to knock everybody's heads together. So very, very interesting. In terms of collaboration then, I mean, obviously that's a very good example of how you've brought member state representatives together. Are there examples of, you know, concrete initiatives or partnerships that you have developed or participated in over the last number of years that you think have been fruitful, or at least have the potential to bear fruit in time? I'd be interesting just to hear a little bit about maybe some of the projects. I know you're funding a lot of initiatives.
Yes. Maybe to just point to two other networks that have been key. One is a roundtable that we call every 3 months here in Brussels with the Jewish umbrella organizations, which also means that they among each other collaborate more closely. And despite all their diversity, I think they see that their work is very complementary, certainly from our perspective. You know, some work more with the parliament, others work more with member states, others more with local communities. So you have this broad range, and actually we can use all of their initiatives and actions to make sure that we address the different areas that we cover in the strategy as well. And the other important aspect was that as a reaction to my appointment, many member states, but also other organizations like the Organization of American States, mainly dealing with Latin America and the US, but also some of the non-European states have appointed special envoys that collaborate very closely in order to make our voice heard in an international context. And we meet twice a year, facilitated by the World Jewish Congress, where the World Jewish Congress brings in the presidents of global Jewish communities, and we have an exchange on specific issues. So this is very important because many of us are not Jewish. I'm not Jewish myself either. Yeah, we need to have this constant dialogue in order to make sure that we get it right on a state level. So these two fora are just also very important. And when it comes to really change makers in terms of projects, what we have in the strategy is one important aspect with regards to Holocaust remembrance. Obviously, a lot is changing there. In the next 10 years, we will have to find new ways of educating. As we have no survivors, we will have no survivors with us anymore. We are therefore, for example, creating now a network of places where the Holocaust happened. There are over 44,000 sites in Europe where the Holocaust happened. So it's not just the big concentration camps. It's also local sites, deportation sites, places where Jews were hidden, but also the places where, for example, children were received from the Kinder transports. Yeah, so there are lots of different aspects to places where the Holocaust happened. And I believe personally that as we will not have the firsthand testimonies anymore, these sites become more and more important because they speak of what happened, and they speak of the fact that it happened locally, that people had a choice, that today, as we see anti-Semitism and other forms of hatred on the rise, we need to speak up, that we cannot let it slip. You know, there are many things to be learned from these sites. So this is one important project that we are building at the moment. And it's really important for us to ensure that we have the member states on board, the key organizations, the key sites, you know, to make sure that in the future, this will be the place to go to when you look at, has there been a site in my town? Yeah, that's one project that's very close to my heart. There's another one which is about young European ambassadors on promoting Holocaust remembrance, to train young people in a one-year project. This is led by the Mémorial de la Shoah in Paris. At the moment in 6 countries, but to be extended, about the facts of the Holocaust, about stories, about testimonies, for them to be able to initiate Holocaust remembrance in their local setting. And then we will add a digital aspect to this, learning from a project that is done by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Israel, to pair Holocaust survivors with influencers online for 1 year, for them to get to know each other, for these influencers then online to also tell the story of their survivor and learn facts about the Holocaust. So this is another important initiative that will, I think, trigger a lot of knowledge in the broader sphere. So, of course, curricula in school are important, training the teachers and all of that is also important. But I believe that we need to go far beyond in order to make sure the Holocaust is remembered. With regards to research, I already spoke about the need to have more research organized. We're creating a hub that will combine. We've done a mapping on, you know, where this kind of research on anti-Semitism in Jewish life is already happening, and to create synergies there. And to also make sure that online, with the network of fact checkers and trusted flaggers, we can make a difference.
Yeah, I think that as a resource will be so important. I know we're getting to the end of our time, but a quick question relating to that sort of research, which obviously helps your understanding of the trends. I mean, have you observed specific trends around anti-Semitism in Europe in recent years? Speaking on some of the other podcasts that we have recorded, one of the guests was flagging the fact that instances of actual anti-Semitic attacks in France had dropped slightly since COVID-19, which maybe is a bit counterintuitive because of all of the conspiracy theories which were flying around during COVID. Whereas in the United States, the instances of actual attacks and violence related to anti-Semitism has gone up. So
yeah,
I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that perhaps a signal of some degree of success or some positive developments in some EU member states, perhaps because of some of the awareness raising work that you're doing? Or what do you think about that?
We have, unfortunately, for example, also in Germany seen last year the highest number of physical attacks on Jews. So I would wish it is a trend. What we see in definitely is that where countries start to record incidents more thoroughly and where they create better mechanisms to report anti-Semitic incidents, for example, apps or being able to report an incident anonymously, you know, having, for example, also concrete victim support so people don't have to re-explain to the law enforcement authorities why they think that a certain expression was hate speech. You know, so this kind of aspects, they increase the number of anti-Semitic incidents. And so we have to, I mean, the numbers in themselves say something, but not necessarily what we would expect, that when you see an increase, that it's always directly also an increase of anti-Semitism as such. Because we have some countries, and actually the Fundamental Rights Agency every year brings out an overview over anti-Semitic incidents, and some countries still report 0 incidents. So I wish it was true, but most likely it just is the fact that there is no recording of these incidents. Yeah. So I think that's important to see. I think an important trend is also that we see anti-Semitism, and that had to do with COVID, with the increase of conspiracy myths, but also with the fact that we all spend much more time in front of the screen. We see an increase of anti-Semitism coming from the middle of society. And we could even watch in real time how different groups connected over anti-Semitism. So they connect on very little. But when it comes to anti-Semitism, they can all agree that somehow the Jews are responsible. And that was very evident in the first weeks of the pandemic. And by the way, that's another aspect of being anti-Semitism being a threat to democracy, because if you think that instead of your elected political representatives, actually the Jews behind the scenes make these corona measures, then your trust in democracy is very low. And this, I think we can see more and more that there is a correlation between different forms of distrust in democracy, in measures by the state, so it's not no longer only in the fringes where we've seen this for a long time, that the Islamist extremists, the left-wing extremists and the right-wing extremists could agree on Jew hatred. But it is unfortunately also in the middle. And that means it's also expressed more overtly in the cocktail parties and so on, and without counter speech. And I think this is really the challenge for each of us, for everyone also listening to this podcast. And I think it's also something that you have with your counter-extremism project engaged very actively. We all have to address hate speech when we hear it, and anti-Semitism when we encounter it. So that's why in the end, whatever we do here on European level is very relevant for the individual as well.
Absolutely. You've sort of answered what was going to be my final question, because I was going to ask you, you know, besides civil society and various community groups and, of course, governments, you know, what can individuals do? But I actually think that you have really summarized it very well. And the one thing that I find somewhat disturbing from this conversation is the way in which this anti-Semitic rhetoric has become more mainstream and more prolific in the center. And as you've described, at the cocktail parties and dinner parties. And that is a very important takeaway, I think, for me from this discussion, that this sort of normalization of this rhetoric is something that we really do have to stand up to. So I think on that note, I would like to really thank you for the work that you're doing, which I think is so important, but for taking the time to share your experience, your work to date, your plans for the future. It's very inspiring and it's very timely. And so all I can do at this point is thank you very much, Katharina von Schnurbein, for joining this podcast, for sharing your insights. And I very much look forward to coming back and talking to you some more in the future about some of those very interesting projects that you have referenced in this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. And I'll be looking forward to continuing the conversation.
Thanks. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
We hope you've enjoyed our discussion. Please don't forget to like, comment on, and share this episode. You can find out more about Fighting Terror and the Counter-Extremism Project on Twitter using our handle @FightExtremism and on the homepage of our website.